Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello and welcome to Blue Murder Club. My name is Lauren and today I'm here with...
It's Carrie. Hello.
Hello. Oh, that was rather nice. Hello. How are you?
I am just trying to put on my posh telephone voice.
I love it. Should we try talking like that? I can't keep it up.
No, neither can I.
How's your week been?
Yeah, not bad, thank you. You know, I went to see Dawn French the other night.
Nice.
At the London Palladium. Yep. Do you know what? No one could go with me, so I thought, sod it, and I went on my own.
You're so brave.
But, do you know what? I'm the best one anyway.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm joking. That's true. No, it's fine. I do a lot of things on my own anyway, so it doesn't bother me.
No, you're so brave. And to be fair, what a bloody thing to do. Done you.
Thanks. Yeah, I didn't want to miss her because who knows when she'll do it again.
Yeah, that's true.
And she was well worth it. She was really funny and it was a really good night out and I didn't care I was on my own. I still enjoyed it.
The little snippet when you told me about it, it's like you was laughing so hard.
Yeah.
That you was like...
I nearly started to cry.
Yeah. I'd love it. Oh, love ya.
Yeah, she did so few things where I was literally like, I need to get a grip of myself because I'm going to start actually crying because I was so laughing so much. So, yeah, it didn't spoil my night at all going on my own.
Oh,
It was really good.
That's good.
Had a nice time. What you been up to?
Not a lot really, but we have got something massive coming up next week because it's Halloween.
Mm.
We've got a P-A-R-T-Y, baby.
I've been practicing the Thriller choreography all week.
Oh, good girl.
Just to nail it.
I haven't even started yet. I'm going to just be, I used to be just the drunk mess in the corner, but I don't drink anymore, so this should be fun.
Yeah, well, I bought some hangover cures. They came today, so... Because I can't drink. I'll have like a couple of beers and I feel absolutely terrible the next day. So I was kind of worried about it.
Yeah.
So I thought, let's see if there's... I used to get this stuff called Resolve.
Yes,
and they stopped making
that.
That's what got me through my 20s, to be honest. And I thought, you can't get it anymore. But you can get like something similar. It's got electrolytes in it and salts and things like that with stuff you need to replenish. So I've ordered some. So hopefully it'll work.
Do you know what always works with me? Dyrolite. Same thing though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is actually. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I could have just got some of that.
Yeah, I down a Dyrolite and I'm good. Well, I used to be good as but normal, because it replaces all the salts and the electrolytes.
Hydration and stuff.
Well,
so
we'll have a go.
Yeah.
I'm going to get you thoroughly drunk and you can tell me if it works.
Yeah.
So yeah, there.
Yeah. So do you want to tell us a little bit? Well, what's this week's episode called?
So we're on series 6, episode 5, and we're doing Peter Manuel, the Beast of Berkenshaw.
Yeah, and we came up with this case, didn't we? Because when we did our Blue Murder Talks episode with Dawn Young,
the lovely Dawn.
Big shout out going out to Dawn Young from
Scottish
Murders. She recommended this case to us, didn't she?
She did. She really did. Thank you fucking very much, Dawn. What a case this was. It was hard work, wasn't it?
It is a big case because this man is a habitual criminal, isn't he?
Yeah.
You name it, crime, he's done it.
He's got every finger in every pie.
Yeah, he doesn't only rob, he doesn't only murder, he does everything, doesn't he? So it was, it took us about a couple of weeks, hasn't it, to sit down and do this one because all the research we've had to do, but it's worth it. It's quite an old case as well, isn't it? So it's quite interesting going back in time and seeing how the police would have solved a crime like this without the benefit of DNA, CCTV, all the mod cons that we have nowadays that you take for granted. So yeah. I quite like that element of it, did
I
you?
I did, yeah. I just pictured, like, you know, like silent film policemen with the... Yeah,
they're all in black and white.
Yeah, and they're all running around. Yeah, like a slapstick. Yeah. That's what I was thinking. That's what I pictured.
Yeah, I don't know, because it's Scotland and... Usually, I don't know what it was with this fella, but it seemed to be Christmas and New Year triggered him for a lot of his crimes. I just imagine being freezing cold.
Yeah.
Dark, snowy, that
it's
kind of
freezing,
thing.
Freezing, yeah.
I love it. So, yeah. So, I think you're going to take us back, aren't you, to the early days of Peter Manuel's
life?
Yeah,
let's go back again.
The beast, the rat.
The rat, self-proclaimed.
Self-proclaimed Frankenstein.
Yeah. Oh, he was full of himself.
Yes, yeah. Really just.
So let's see, and we're going to see if nature and nurture takes a play in this as well.
Well, yeah, there wasn't anything to indicate he was shaped
definitely
to be this
not
way, was there? He was definitely born bad. And there weren't even like a bang to the head in his youth.
Just a naughty boy.
Yeah, just a naughty boy.
Yeah, very. Yeah, no bangs to the head.
No childhood trauma.
No.
Absolutely
the
no
only thing is he had
all
was parents that were enablers. Other than that, he had nothing
but
at
most
all
people do.
Yeah.
Most people's parents let them do what the fuck they want, especially nowadays.
My kid wouldn't do that. My kid don't do that.
Yeah, exactly.
That's why I stopped teaching dancing, because of that.
Yeah, exactly.
Not my kid.
No, not my kid.
Definitely not.
Yeah. I think like, he
was. My son, poor fucker, is guilty until proven innocent.
Yeah.
I'm like, what's he done there? Whereas most, not my kid. My kid wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
So, you ready?
Yeah, let's get cracking.
Let's do this. So, by the 1920s, the Great War had ended, but there was still conflict and unrest with general strike riots. The Irish War of Independence was raging and tensions were high in Glasgow. It was the industrial belt of the central Scotland and a major shipbuilding centre, and it was hit hard by the slump of the Great Depression. 2 million people immigrated from Scotland to seek work and a better life. Samuel and Bridget Manuel took to the seas to America, leaving behind a son called James with family members. They took residence in Manhattan and they found out that Bridget was pregnant, and so she gave birth to a baby boy called Peter, Thomas Anthony Manuel. He was born on the 15th of March 1927 in New York. They hoped to reunite James with his sibling as soon as possible when their money situation improved. So I think at the minute they're just trying to make some roots. I think that Peter may have been a bit of a surprise because they're trying to get the money to send over for their other child.
Yeah.
So, yeah. They
trying
moved
to get established in a new country can't be easy.
No, definitely not. So they moved on again to Detroit after the Wall Street crash in 1929, hoping their relocation would improve their prospects. Samuel worked as a welder in a car factory and Bridget was a domestic servant.
Motown Detroit, isn't it?
Yes. Mm. No, you know what else I was thinking? 8 Mile. Because that's in Detroit, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it is, isn't it?
It is, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And there's a pawn shop on one of the old pawn shop old television reality TV things, and that's in Detroit. I can't think of it.
Yeah.
It's called Pawn Stars. That's what it's called.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Got
sorry.
You.
Yeah, I was struggling now. Bad. Yeah, so Samuel worked as a welder in a car factory and Bridget was a domestic servant, but their luck didn't improve when Samuel became poorly and it forced the family to head back to Scotland in 1932. The family then reunited with James and they moved around from Motherwell and finally settling in at Coventry in 1937. By this time, Peter was 10 years old. He had an American accent and he didn't fit in with his peers. He found it difficult adapting and he was a target for bullying. His parents then went on to have a third child, Teresa, which pushed Peter even further into himself. At the age of 10, being ridiculed and isolated, he began to lash out. He started to steal and was frequently in trouble with the police. I was going to say the popo.
In trouble with the Pope.
Yeah. Well, lucky you should say that, because he went so far to steal a local chapel's collection box.
Oh, so he would have been in trouble
with the Pope. He would have been in trouble with the Pope. Fuck me, you're a genius. I'm going to call you the next fortune teller. What was his name?
Well, I'm the Oracle.
Yeah, you're the Oracle.
Yeah.
I'll take it.
I could be the Oracle.
Yeah, I think you could.
Yeah.
So he went, because of his bad behaviour at school, as well as at home, he was sent to a youth detention centre in 1943. He used to escape overnight and committed crime after crime, 11 that's recorded. Peter and another youth was committed a robbery and the damage was so bad, it was described as such enormity that words could not describe it properly. They totally trashed the place and even threw food on the floor.
You know what, when I was researching this case mm-hmm. and I read about this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Do you know what it reminded me of?
Go on.
Right, I'm sure everybody's seen the film Home Alone.
Yeah.
Do you remember the baddies in it? They called themselves the Wet Bandits.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was their calling cards, was to turn all the taps on and plug the plug.
Yes.
And flood the houses that they burgled. So when they caught them for one crime, the police would be able to, like, just charge them with another 20 crimes at the same MO.
Yeah.
So it's like this fella here, I think his favourite thing was to chuck tinned fruit.
Tinned fruit, yeah.
All over the place. So once they caught him, they could literally charge him with every single other
because of all the
burglary that had tin fruit.
So, do you think he was going around with a tin opener?
He must have been, because back then they wouldn't have had those ring pull cans, would they?
No, fucking just throwing fruit about the place. Yeah. And that's what they said. Like, that's what the police said. Like, they just trashed it, soiled it. Not shit yourself, but sold the place, like walking mud everywhere.
No dirty protests then.
No dirty protests.
That is what you made it sound a bit like.
Yeah, I wanted it to sound like that, to be fair. Get a bit of interest in it.
Yeah.
Have that.
Yeah. But fancy doing that, just going in, tipping tin fruit everywhere.
Maniac.
Sticky.
Absolute maniac.
Ugh, sticky.
Yeah. Oh, like no.
Peaches in syrup. Oh,
yeah. Yeah, I'd just take all the wrappers off the tin so he wouldn't know what one was tin throat.
Yeah, but then he might spill beans everywhere. Yeah. That'd be worse.
Yeah, that would be worse, to be fair.
Yeah. It's a funny thing to do, though, for like a 15-year-old kid. The whole thing is just weird, isn't it?
He's
definitely
weird.
Got some nuts, screws loose, I think.
Yeah.
You know, I know that's a technical
mental
term.
Mental.
Yeah.
Fucking mental.
Mm.
So, where was I at? I can't remember. Oh, yes, so he was moved all over the country to different detention centres because of all the crimes he was committing. And at the age of 15, his behaviour became so out of control, he started a series of brutal attacks. He broke into a night worker from the boarding home. So it was a woman, she was living at the boarding home working overnight there. And he attacked her while we were sleeping over the head with a hammer. The judge sent him to Leeds prison, so this is the first time he's incarcerated that we know of. While he was in prison, his family moved from Lancashire because of the Blitz of Coventry in World War II. It was hit really hard, and the air raid on Coventry on the night of the 14th of November 1940 was the single most concentrated attack on a British city in the Second World War. So when he gets released, he moves back to be near his family, back to Scotland.
How old did you say he was when he hit that woman over the edge with a hammer?
15.
That's young.
Very, very young, and a very vicious attack.
Because if you're hitting someone over the head while they're asleep with a hammer, your intention surely is to kill them.
And I thought to myself, what has she done to him to make him that angry? What's angered him so bad?
I don't know whether he just wanted to make her unconscious, or if you wanted to kill her, you just don't know.
No.
There's never any, he never really explains why he does anything,
no, he
does
doesn't.
He? There's never any motive for any of it.
No, and I think he always denies everything as well, doesn't he? Kind of. No,
not really.
Oh, okay.
he's a bit of a show off.
Ah.
So, yeah, he's a bit of a show
he's
off.
He's a massive
one.
Liar. I've got that much.
Yeah.
Massive. Pinocchio to the full extent. He knows he's going from Coventry back up to Scotland.
Yeah. But for a 15 or 16-year-old to be trying to attempt to murder an adult, that's pretty off the chart, isn't it?
Yeah, massively. So his list of offences was getting bigger and bigger, and the amount of home break-ins were higher in and around the area of Sandy Hill, where the family lived. Peter would climb up the drain pipes to break in and rob the homes, and in February 1946, Peter broke into a bungalow in the Sandy Hills area of Glasgow while the family who lived there were on holiday. The local police carried out a routine fingerprint examination. They were called out the same time to another burglary the same day. They found that there was family jewellery just sitting on the side, and when the crime scene officer had finished, they left. However, Detective Sergeant William Muncy realised they had forgotten a piece of evidence with clear fingerprints on it, and it was a glass. Detective Mency decided to return. He spotted Peter in the garden. So what it turned out, Kaz, that while the police was doing their finger search, Peter was hiding behind the wood paneling in the loft.
It's creepy, isn't it?
Yeah. He was staying up at the property and he even had a bed made up. So while the family was away, he just, sat pretty.
God.
Peter was actually leaving the property, and when he got searched, he had the family jewels that they had just seen on the side on him. So they knew, obviously, that he was the robber. Yeah, so Peter broke into another house, and in this house, he sexually attacked the woman that was sleeping there. But he also trashed it. And guess what he trashed it with, Kez?
Fruity Bandits?
Yep, Fruity Patootie. So this is where Detective Mancy knew he had his man, as Peter liked to open tin fruit and throw them everywhere, in every robbery, just like he did in his early crimes with his mate, what we was talking about earlier.
Yeah.
So Peter was arrested and the court date was set for March, but Daddy Samuel paid Peter's bail money of £60 and it was with dire consequences. So he's got, you're not going, here's your bail money. So on the 3rd of March, a mother and a three-year-old child was walking down an alley. She felt uneasy and like someone was watching her. It was in fact Peter. He jumped onto the woman and they fell and scrambled as she tried to free herself. They hit a barbed wire fence and she screamed, which made Peter start leering towards the child and walking back up to the path towards the child. And something happened. She was unsure what, but he turns his attention back on her. And he starts to kick her and left her lying there to get back to the child, like she's scrambling, trying to get back to her child, and he just runs away. There was no sexual abuse there. Unsure if this attack was just a test or he was starting his rampage on women. The survivor managed to give the police a full description of her attacker, and they even found Peter's hair and a hat that had been altered to make smaller at the scene. So on the 7th of March, Peter was leaning up against a fence on a public road when he saw a young woman walking. She was a nurse just finishing a shift, and on her way home, Peter flies at her in a rage and punches her straight in the face. Fucking awful, isn't it?
Yeah.
He gagged her with his hand to stop her from screaming and she fought back. Now, this woman had just had a hysterectomy about 3 months prior, and so she must have been in fucking agony, Kaz. Agony. And when he's here, he's knocked her teeth from her head. So it's an hard old punch, isn't it?
Yeah.
So he gagged her with his hand to stop her from screaming, and she fought back, and she managed to scream and got the attention of a passing driver, and he interrupted the assault. Peter then ran away. It's like Peter fucking Pan, keep flying away, doesn't he? Peter was getting worked up by this point, and a day later, 2 miles from the last attack, a 26-year-old woman was just making her way off a bus and started to walk home when she spotted Peter at the bus stop and instantly had a gut feeling about him. Maybe he had a manic look in his eye for it, question mark.
Yeah.
She noticed him following her 10 minutes down the road, and he was getting closer and closer, and that's a fucking horrible feeling, isn't it? When you're walking down the road and someone's approaching you, and you're thinking, oh, I'm going a bit faster, and they're going a bit faster, and you're thinking, I'll go even quicker. And like, it's fucking scary. So when she's turned, he's right on her. And again, as the same time as before, he just flew at her, punched her in the face and gagged her. She fell, but as she's fell, like, she's tried to bite his hand, and he was livid with her. He was enraged, and he hit her head against the floor, and he told her to shut up and forced her into a to walk to a hidden spot. When she screamed, he would kick her in the face, knocking out her teeth. He raped her in the hidden spot. He tied a scarf around her eyes and then ran away. She goes to the police later in that evening and gives a detailed description. They held an ID parade, and Peter was in this parade. And so the first two survivors of this identify Peter, with the first one even fainting when she see him straight away. The third one wasn't sure it was him. So with this, they had a search of Peter's flat, where they found more hats made especially for his smaller head. They had enough evidence, and after 45 recorded criminal acts, the last one was the one that he got saw him charged. So the one that didn't recognise him in the ID report was the one he actually got charged for.
Yeah.
So he was sentenced as an adult for the first time to 8 years at Peterhead Prison on top of the 12 months he got for the earlier charges. So you know, remember he was on bail?
Mm-hmm.
So that 12 months plus the 8 years he's got for this. He was seen as the Scotland's toughest prisoner at the time. Peter was described as an arrogant and boastful by fellow prisoners and full of himself. He told fellow prisoners he was in there for blowing a safe and robbery as he didn't want to be seen as a sexual offender. Knowing, as we know from old Spoons last week,
yeah.
What happens if you are a sexual offender? Yeah. Fucking, I wish Spoons was in there with him, I tell ya.
Spoons would sort him out.
Yeah, he would. So he also told him that his father had been given the electric chair in an American prison and that he was an infamous mobster. So he's just splurting all these lies. He spent the time in prison learning to read and write stories, and he showed the guards that he was rehabilitated. And at the age of 26 in 1954, Peter was released from prison. Peter, now free, would read the newspapers for a crime fix, and he would tell anyone willing to listen down the local pub all about what crime he was reading about. He made on that he knew a lot more about the crimes than he actually did. He bought a typewriter and then wanted to become a journalist. So I just think this guy just thinks, oh, I can do that, so I'm going to do it. Do you know what I mean? I'm going to buy the typewriter, I can do that.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So mainly focusing on true crimes, he's really trying to reinvent himself. He also started to taunt the police that he had solved the crimes he had been writing about. He was talking bullshit after it, as he was just giving the names of bullies at Peterhead Prison. So he's saying, oh, I know who done that one. And it weren't. It was someone who was giving him a bit of stick in prison.
Yeah.
So then Peter goes on to meet Anna O'Hara. Peter called her the love of his life. He loved Bomza and he just showers her with gifts the lot. He treated her really, really well. She and her family were religious. I think they were Catholic and they had good family values. Peter, showing no signs of his true self, fell deeper in love with her. And in 1955, the loved up couple got engaged and started to wedding plan. Peter was scared of Anna finding out who he really was. So in what I'm guessing he thinks is a genius move, he goes and writes an anonymous letter to Anna saying that the man she was engaged to was a spy and was a secret service officer in Russia. Fucking, you're joking, right? And also that his father had been given the electric chair. Same lies, hadn't it? So when Anna approached him about the letter, he came across cool as cucumber and told her not to worry as he knew who had sent it and that he would sort it. Anna hears through the grapevine about Peter's past and then he lies once more, telling him, that weren't me. No, it was me brother. We're always getting mixed up. Poor old James.
Sounds like, oh, who's that fella that we did who lived in Australia? Can't think what his name is now.
No.
But yeah, there was loads and loads of them, wasn't there? They was always just trying to get off the hook by,
yeah,
like,
by one another.
Yes. Yeah, because there were so many of them.
Yeah, it'll come to me in a minute.
Yeah.
So yeah, the relationship finally came to a head after Peter refused one too many times to go to church with Anna and her family. But I think that's just a bit of a get out clue to Anna. I think she's thinking, you know, it's not you, it's me.
Yeah.
It's one of them, isn't it? It's not you, it's me. I need someone who's going to go to church with me.
Sounds like she's looking for an excuse to dump him. She knows
he's full of shit.
Yeah.
Knows it. So after Ranella had left him, Peter begins to drink heavily. He becomes more hateful towards women. So on the 30th of July 1955, it was the date of the wedding that didn't happen. So in Anna's wedding that actually didn't happen. A woman named Mary McLaughlin was walking along a path that ran along a field. There in the darkness was a drunk Peter sitting in and waiting. He jumped out on Mary and pulled a knife to her throat and led her away from the path onto the field. She managed to get a scream out and local residents heard this and rang the police. Two police officers and a local mob gathered to search the field where the scream was heard. Peter was literally 2 yards away from the search party and he held on to Mary's mouth to make her not scream. That must have been so frightening. And you know, like, you can hear all the commotion around you. if you could just say, I'm here.
Yeah.
Oh. So after an hour, the group had left, and then Peter then tormented Mary. He was sexually abusing her, and all of a sudden he just stopped. Reasons being that he may have completed just from the fear she showed.
Mm.
So he's, yeah, just calmed in his pants, isn't he, really?
Yeah.
Got excited and thought, well, yeah, I've done my job now. Ta-da. So he made her sit there for another hour in utter silence. Then he told Mary that he was drunk and he just lost control. He went on telling her about the wedding and he wanted to drown himself, but he knew how to swim.
God.
I know. He said he had chosen her because she looked like Anna. He apologised and then offered to walk her home. Fucking mad. So she had reported him to the police as soon as she got home. And he was arrested and held in Barlinley prison. He defended himself at trial. Again, full of the big I am, full of the, I'm a lawyer now. Let me just get my lawyer out on and I'll go for it. This is what it is. We had a Bundy. He done it, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
Wow. So, yeah, sorry. He defended himself at trial and cross-examined poor Mary. So imagine that. He told the court that they were dating and they was on a dog walk. They had a lover's quarrel and that he had hit her after a disagreement. They made up after, lying time and time again. The jury believes it and the case was thrown out, leaving him to go on to commit other crimes.
Mm.
So, yeah, I just think that's disgusting. Like, he's been on bail. He's done all these things to women. He's doing all these robberies. And the court just like, meh.
Yeah, I don't know why they believe that. It's very odd.
It's really odd. Like, the actual story is ridiculous. It is absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, and the fact that he defended himself as well, I can't imagine how he managed to do it. But I think quite a lot of the times there was comments by the judge each time, even though he'd committed these heinous crimes, the judge complimented him on his defence skills.
It's fucking ridiculous.
So he must have been good at it.
I think he was just a showman. Yeah. P.M.E. Barnum, innit? What's his name?
Yeah, Barnum.
Barnum, yeah. That's what I've got in my head.
I don't know. Apparently he was really short, so maybe they felt a bit sorry for him.
How tall was he?
5'4".
I think if you're under 5 foot, you're classed as small.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think so.
But that's why he had such small hats, I think, because he must have been quite small all over.
Small in stature.
Yeah, I reckon.
Small penis.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
So I'm going to hand it over to you, Kerry.
Right, so here we are. At around 3 p.m. on the 4th of January 1956, a man named George Ribbon was walking his dog in the now removed East Kilbride golf course in the Calderwood area of Lanarkshire in Scotland. While looking for golf balls, he noticed what looked like a sunbather in the distance of the green, and upon further inspection he discovered the horrifying sight of the scattered remains of a young woman. When the police arrived, they found her jewellery, her clothes and shoes in the blood-soaked area. It seemed to indicate that this poor woman had been running for her life for hundreds of yards before her assailant had caught up to her. The police immediately knew who this young girl was, 17-year-old Anne Neelands, whose parents had literally just reported her missing earlier that day, and she'd vanished about 2 or 3 days before. So, she vanished on New Year's Day, 1st of January. Mm-hmm. The week before, the Friday before, Anne and her sister Alice had met two young men at a dance in the town hall in East Kilbride. Anne danced with a man called Private Andrew Merlin from the Parachute Regiment. They'd hit it off and they agreed to meet up the following week and go to another dance. The plan had been to meet at the bus station in East Kilbride at 6 p.m. on Monday the 1st of January and then to make their way to the dance in Glasgow together from there. Anne was so excited that she forego the Hogmanay celebrations the night before to be fresh for her date on New Year's Day.
Oh, love her.
So, obviously, New Year's Eve is massive in Scotland.
Yep, Scotland.
So, she obviously was properly excited and it was a big deal to her. But sadly, when Anne arrived at the rendezvous, she was left waiting for a date that would never happen. After a while, she popped to the home of a family friend, the Simpsons, at their farm to put on makeup, as she was known to do. I think her parents wouldn't let her wear makeup, so she'd pop round there and put her makeup on and then go out. And she left the farm at 6:40, saying that she had a bus to catch, her intention being that he might just be running late and they can catch the later bus and still go out to Glasgow. Eyewitnesses later confirmed that Anne had never caught a bus and was seen just hanging around looking a bit lost. She was probably a bit embarrassed to go home and admitting that she'd been stood up. And when the police tracked down Private Merlin, he had celebrated Hogmanay so hard that he hadn't even woken up until 7 p.m. on the 1st of January.
Oh, so he didn't keep the same course.
He slept through the date, because he was so hungover. Anne's mum and dad had gone to Glasgow on the 2nd of January, so it wasn't until the 4th that they became worried and reported her missing, assuming that she was staying with a friend. And just a few hours later, her remains were found. Once they had gathered the evidence, the police deduced that Anne must have encountered her attacker near the golf course, as one of her shoes was found near the road, and footprints could be seen where she had fled for her life over 200 yards of golf course when her attacker caught up with her. She'd been dragged into the trees and undergrowth nearby, where she was killed by bludgeoning her with a blunt instrument and presumably raping her as her underwear was removed. Manuel was working nearby on a gas pipe laying squad plumbing in for the new town. He was 28 at the time, but his record of attacks on women was well known. He had been jailed at 16 for sexual assault, serving 9 years in Peterhead with subsequent arrest for rape. When questioned by police, he mentioned that a worker's hut had been broken into a few days before, quite near to the crime scene, and he explained that a pair of wellies and the handle of a pickaxe had been stolen. Following the search of the crime scene, the pickaxe was found and determined to be the murder weapon. So immediately they're like, who is this man? Why does he know so much about it? Why did he say pickaxe? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's all a bit odd, isn't it?
Yeah, and he's got this massive criminal record. He stands out like a sore thumb.
Yeah.
He works right next to the golf course. Following the search of the crime scene, the pickaxe was found and determined... Sorry, I just said that. When the press heard who had divulged this information, they went to interview Peter Manuel. And the photographer, whose name is in dispute, I've got either Harry Benson or Ronnie Burgess. Oh. Apologies to either of you men. I don't know. Two different sources, two different names. But it's the same person. He's a photographer, accompanied the reporter. And he said that he was sent to cover the murder scene. And he recalls one policeman saying, this is the work of Peter Manuel.
Wow.
His impression was that Peter was handsome, but short, only 5'4", with black eyes. And when he asked to photograph him, Peter snapped and said no photos. But Ronnie went ahead and he took a picture of him anyway. And this is quite a famous photo where, I don't know if you saw it, Lauren, when you were doing research, obviously all the pictures are in black and white, but mm-hmm. he's kind of looking sideways at the camera mm-hmm. and he looks pissed off.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the picture that was taken. Oh. And he told Ronnie, I'll get you for that. I think he did. He lingered around his work and stuff, but Ronnie weren't around, so nothing came of it. But, yeah, he sounds like he threatened him anyway. Yeah. So Peter was an obvious suspect. He had fresh scratches on his face, which he claimed he got into a fight during Hogmanay.
Mm-hmm.
His home, where he lived with his parents, 32 4th Avenue in Berkenshire, which was near Uddingston, was searched, but no evidence was found. And unfortunately, his father alibied him and he was set free.
Oh, here we go again. Samuel to the rescue.
Yeah, so yeah, this is Samuel just lying through his teeth again. It was an ordinary Sunday evening for 16-year-old Vivian Watt, who lived in the middle-class area of Burnside, Lancashire, in a respectable bungalow with her mum and dad, Marion and William. William was a successful businessman and they were just a very nice, normal family. Like a lot of teenagers, Marion enjoyed spending time with her friends at the weekends, and on this particular Sunday, she had gone to Glasgow with her friend and next-door neighbour for the day. When they came home, they listened to the pop parade on Radio Luxembourg with her mum and her auntie Margaret Brown, who was staying over for the evening while her dad was away on a fishing trip. Right?
Doris. What happened on that fishing trip? Still need to know.
When I was typing this out, I was just thinking, as soon as I say fishing trip, Lauren's going to start with her Doris.
Where's my salad?
Gavin and Stacey referencing there for the fishing trip. The girls hung out until around 11:45 at night when her friend Deanna Valente went home and Vivian, Margaret and Marion all went to bed. So Vivian went to bed in her own bedroom and by all accounts, Margaret and Marion went to bed together. They slept in the same bed. By 1956, Peter Manuel was an experienced and skilled at breaking and entering, and in the early hours of the 17th of September, he smashed a small pane of glass in the front door and he gained entry to the Watt home. He shot and killed Marion and Margaret while they slept. Then he moved along to Vivian's room where he overpowered her. He tied her hands behind her back. According to the crime scene, she put up a big fight because her bedroom was ruined. You could see that struggle had taken place. Yeah. But he did manage to overpower her. He removed her bottom half of her clothing and he shot her. I think he also removed clothing of her mum and her auntie as well.
Oh no.
So it's definitely sexually motivated, although he didn't rape them or anything, but it's definitely sexually motivated.
She's coming in his pants, isn't
it? Yeah, I think that's by all accounts that's what got his rocks off. Poor Vivian, she was shot. It wasn't until 8:45 the next morning that the family cleaning lady, Helen Collison, she knocked on the door and got no reply that anyone had any idea of the carnage that had taken place that night. Upon getting no answer, she noticed the window had been smashed and she called next door for some help. So she told Mrs. Valente, who was Deanna's mother, and together the two women returned to the Watt house where they encountered the postman. And so together all three of them entered the house. They soon made the appalling discovery of the murders, although Vivian was still bravely clinging on to life. She slipped away before she could make it to hospital. So Vivian, she lasted a few hours. She wasn't quite dead when they discovered her, but she didn't regain consciousness. The police noticed the similarities of the break-ins with a burglary earlier in the week in the same road where nothing had been taken but a big mess was made. And they knew this to be the calling card of Peter Manuel. They immediately went to search his house, but there was no sign of the Webley revolver that had been the murder weapon. And with no other evidence linking Peter to the crimes, their attention turned to Mr. Watt, who had been away at the night of the crime. Now, you know I mentioned that Vivian had a wrist tie behind her back.
Mm-hmm.
He'd used a pair of tights to do that.
Yeah.
Which had been stolen from that burglary earlier in the week. Apparently there was an elderly couple who lived a bit down the road and they'd had
their... Again, why the fuck would you do that? Because then that's linking you to both of them.
I don't know. I couldn't... the whole time I'm doing research, I just couldn't figure out any motivation. No. Why did any of it, to be honest?
It's all sexual, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. But the fact that he picked a pair of tights to do it gives me that vibe. You know, he didn't choose a belt or a tie. It is tights. So I do think it's definitely some kind of sexual motive, isn't it?
Mm.
For a long time, Marion's husband, William, who'd been on a fishing holiday 90 miles away that night, he was...
his nephew. Sorry.
Uncle Bryn. He was suspected of the murders, with witnesses picking him out of an identity parade. The police felt he was too cold and unemotional about the annihilation of his family, and he was arrested and held on remand, but he was released 2 months later. Manuel was out on bail at the time for a nearby burglary at a colliery. So again, this geezer, he just doesn't stop breaking the law, but he never seems to be put in prison for some reason. The investigators preferred Marion's husband, William, when it became known that he'd had multiple affairs and thus had a flimsy motive.
Bastards.
So I suppose they're thinking, obviously he's not got a great character. He cheats on his wife. Perhaps he just wanted to kill her. I mean, it's a very, very flimsy motive.
Yeah.
They wanted to believe that he had driven the 90 miles back during the night, faked a burglary, murdered his family, and then driven back. And they went to extraordinary lengths to stand it up, producing two, inverted commas, witnesses, whose stories were so shaky that they would fall apart at the most cursory examination. Despite the fact that the level of petrol in Mr. Watt's car had not gone down, there was no evidence of him filling up on fuel during the night.
Wow.
There were two separate witnesses at the hotel who saw him really early in the morning. One of the witnesses had seen him scraping the ice off his car at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Ah.
So that kind of indicates that his car hadn't moved all night.
Yeah.
You know, if he'd, been, if he'd driven like nearly 200 miles, the ice would have melted, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I felt like Pyro then. I got it. Yeah. As soon as you said it, I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he drove that all night.
No, exactly. And like, you know, there was, he still had a full tank of fuel.
Yeah.
So there was no indication that he'd topped up using a jerry can or anything like that either, so they were clutching at straws, the police. So after 2 months on remand without producing any substantial piece of evidence, Mr. Watt was released, but he did remain the prime suspect. During his spell in prison, he became famous for being the brutal suspected killer of his own family, and this would only infuriate a fellow inmate, a Peter Manuel, whose ego was such that he couldn't stand it. So, once Mr. Watt was released, he made it his mission to find out who actually had killed his family. He went around to all the pubs, just trying to get involved with the criminal underworld of Glasgow to see what he thought is the best way to get to the killer was to track down who had bought the gun.
Yeah.
So, he's going around all the pubs, speaking to people in the criminal underworld, offering rewards for information. Anyway, it was at that point that he arranged a meeting with Peter Manuel, who claimed to have received information from a prison informant. So Peter Manuel just come out of jail, and straight away he can't stand it. He's like, someone else is getting the glory for my crimes. I'm going to have to get involved,
wow,
kind of thing. I need to tell someone. So the information that he had provided, that he the information he provided proved that he had either been the killer or had had a direct conversation with the man who had killed the women, as he knew that the Watts' sister-in-law, so that was Margaret Brown, that she'd been shot twice. And he could also reveal details about the inside of the Watt home. So he's basically, like, it's just really upsetting a man who's already in a lot of pain. So this was on, let me see, so the 27th November 57, he gets released from prison and he arranges this meeting on Saturday the 30th.
Right.
In the evening, and they met, Where did they meet? I've got it written down here. The White Hall. The White Hall restaurant in Glasgow.
Right.
And during their meeting, he showed William Watt, which is very strange, a photo of Anne Neely, like the girl that he killed on the golf course. He showed and asked William if he knew her. William said, no, I don't know who she is. And then he tore it up in front of him. The men were strongly felt that he was taunting him. The police were informed of the meeting and Peter's odd behaviour, but once again he wasn't charged due to a lack of evidence.
Oh, for fuck's
sake. At that meeting, William brought his solicitor Lawrence Dowdall with him to the meeting, and Lawrence Dowdall, the solicitor, went to the police and said, look, this very strange meeting with this Peter Manuel. Peter Manuel's name's coming up over and over again, but there's nothing physical to tie and they can't find the murder weapon and the gun, it's not at the house. So,
but surely him saying
stuff
that nobody but the killer will know.
Well, no, yeah, exactly.
But come on.
Well,
man.
He said, oh, I've just come out of prison. Someone told me, but I'm not going to tell you who. But somebody did tell me.
Yeah, yourself. Yeah. Yourself told yourself.
Yeah. But I think.
Oh, I'm so angry.
The feeling of William Watt was that he knew who it was, but he wouldn't say who it was, kind of thing. I don't think even he suspected it was Peter Manuel.
Oh, okay.
Here we are, moving on to another poor victim, Sydney Dunn. So the 1957 murder of Newcastle taxi driver Sydney John Dunn is a crime that sits uneasily in a series of Manuel's crimes. It's the only crime that took place outside of Scotland, and the victim was male rather than female or a family, with no apparent motive. And even though he was convicted for the crime in 1958, nearly 60 years later, there's still doubts whether he was actually innocent. But while he was in prison waiting for his trial later on, he wrote a poem and he said that he did kill Sidney Dunn, so who knows?
Yeah.
Like you say, the man couldn't tell the truth.
No.
His life depended on it, so who knows? So this is the case of Sidney Dunn. In the early hours of Sunday, the 8th of September, 1957, two taxi drivers were waiting under the portico of Newcastle Central Station. The two taxi drivers were Thomas Green and Sidney John Dunn, who was age 36 at the time. And the pair were friends and neighbours. They both lived on St Thomas's Crescent in Newcastle. Thomas Green noticed two men emerge from the station at the same time. One of the men asked to be taken to the Newburn area, 6 miles away, and the other to a village called Edmund Byers in the moors of County Durham, 22 miles away. So Thomas Green chose the shorter fare and he directed the other man who wanted to travel 22 mm-hmm. miles away to Sidney Dunn's cab. So he got a really good look at the man.
Right.
That's the point of me telling you that. Thomas Green would later describe Dunn's passenger as approximately 24 years of age, 5'8" tall, swarthy, with greased black hair parted to the left, medium build, wearing a single-breasted dark suit, no hat and no overcoat. And he would later tell the police that he'd followed Dunn's cab until they parted company at Scotswood Bridge. But what happened after is still as much of a mystery now as it was then. So it don't sound like a description of him.
No.
Already he's 4 inches too tall. He's too young because at that point I think he was sort of like in his early 30s or late 20s. He wasn't 24 at that point.
But maybe because he was so small he looked younger.
Yeah, maybe he did, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like the perception. Yeah. If I see... I don't know.
Yeah, but maybe. Yeah. Could be. But I just think... I think 5'4 and 5'8 is quite different, isn't it?
Yeah, it is extremely different.
Isn't it?
4 inches, that's what they also be.
So Dunn's cab would be found some hours later and several miles away, abandoned in a gully off the main road to Stanhope. A police cyclist came across the abandoned vehicle, which was left at a right angle to the road. Both the interior and exterior lights were smashed, and both the front and rear driver's side doors were lying open. There was blood on the steering wheel, and a scarf and a peaked cap lie on the grass beside the car. The policeman initially believed the scene was nothing more ominous than a traffic accident and cycled the 2 miles to Edmund Byers to check whether there were any reports of an accident or anyone admitted to hospital with head injuries, but he drew a blank. A search team was quickly assembled and soon a tracker dog found the body of Sidney John Dunn lying in the heather about 150 yards away from the car where he'd been dragged to the spot by the tails of his coat. His wallet lay nearby, but there were no signs of a robbery. Some debris was found near the body and a post-mortem would later reveal the cause of death was a bullet wound to the head. It was likely shot at least 12 inches from his head and from a very worn revolver. The blood splatters in the car suggested the shot had been fired from the front passenger seat. After inflicting the fatal shot to the head, the killer had also slashed his throat.
Oh, no.
Weird, isn't it?
See, this, I don't get him from this at all.
No, it's funny, isn't it?
It's really weird, yeah.
It is weird.
I've got hitchhiker, that's got hitchhiker all over it, isn't it? Front passenger seat.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, I don't
I'm
know.
I'm not saying, yeah.
He picked him up from the train station, didn't he? Because his mates directed him to the cabbie, so God knows. I mean, he must have intended to do it, because people don't walk around with guns in their pockets, do they?
Do you think he slighted him in some way that we don't know about, and that's why he's done it?
I don't know, because he didn't rob him. It weren't money, was it? So no. I don't know. It's very strange. So door-to-door inquiries led nowhere, nor did a search of the surrounding moorland. In particular, no one came forward to tell of either seeing or giving a lift to an inappropriately dressed man walking along the side of the moors in the midst of a gale, for there was very real risk of exposure for anyone attempting to walk from where the car was found to a place of shelter. And police were at a loss to explain how the killer had left the scene and even suggested he may have fallen into a peat bog and died. And they were equally puzzled why the killer had not just driven away in the car. Was the killer unable to drive? Who knows? So how was it that the murder of a taxi driver in Newcastle came to be attributed to Peter Manuel, a killer who usually committed his crimes in Glasgow? Well, Manuel had been in the area at the time of the murder, attending a job interview in Newcastle on the morning of Friday the 6th of December, so a couple of days before, the day before the murder. And when a serial killer with a preference for using guns happens to be in the same vicinity as a seemingly motiveless shooting, it takes no great leap to draw a connection between the two. Furthermore, the scattering of Dunn's belongings recalls similar scatterings. So, you know, like you mentioned, the messes that he likes to make. So he just likes to spread things around all over the floor after he's done a crime. It's weird,
shit.
Isn't it?
Sorry, it's not shit.
It's just, he's just a bit of a calling card, isn't it?
Well, you said mess. And I said soiling, and it's just got like he's doing dirty progress everywhere. Sorry.
True. There were several other important pieces of evidence that were used to convict Manuel of the murder. So grass was found in the turn-ups of a pair of Manuel's trousers that were found to be similar to that found on the moors. And a button with thread attached recovered from the floor of Sydney's cab was similar to those of a coat belonging to Manuel. Two red fibres and a yellow thread entwined in that button were thought to have possibly come from clothing belonging to Manuel. And we do know that Manuel committed the Watt murders with a .38 revolver. Mm-hmm. But it couldn't have been the same weapon as Manuel had already disposed of that gun. So God knows. But most convincingly, the taxi driver Green, who'd spoken to Dunn's passenger, was able to identify Manuel as that man. Ah, so there's an eyewitness identification. So who knows? There's a lot of conflicting things there, I think.
Yeah.
I'm not convinced, but also he does confess to it later on.
Yeah.
Because
he wants to be Billy Big Bollocks.
Yeah, this is the thing. He likes the fame, doesn't he?
Yeah.
So there's lingering doubts as to Manuel's guilt in the death of Sidney John Dunn. It remained for nearly 50 years until Manuel himself appeared to silence them from beyond the grave, because in 2009, a poem composed by Manuel while awaiting his execution was unearthed in the personal papers of Duncan Mackenzie, the former governor of Barlinnie Prison. In it, Manuel described himself as the foulest beast on earth and Scotland's Frankenstein, but he also confesses for the first and only time to the murders of Sidney John Dunn, writing, "I murdered Isabella Cook and young Anne Neelands too, shot the Watts and shot the Smarts, and Sidney Dunn I slew." So there we have it. From the horse's mouth, Lauren.
Yeah.
Make of that what you will.
Yeah.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Now we have another one here, I'm afraid, another murder that he did. 17-year-old Isabel Cook, a sixth form pupil at Hamilton Academy, lived with her parents and three younger brothers at No. 5 Carrick Drive in Mount Vernon. On the afternoon of the 28th of December 1957, Mr. and Mrs. Cook had left home at around 4 p.m, leaving Isabel and her three brothers and Mr. Cook's mother in the house. The Cooks returned home about 8 p.m, but Isabel was not home. This did not immediately raise concerns because her parents assumed she'd already arrived safely at the hockey club dance held at the Masonic Hall in Uddingston, which she planned to attend with her boyfriend, 16-year-old Douglas Bryden. But Isabel had not arrived, and by the time her parents arrived home, she was already dead.
Oh.
She'd left home at 6:45 in order to catch a 7:30 bus. Her father, William Cook, would later tell reporters that she almost certainly would have taken the shortcut leading from the blind end of the cul-de-sac where they lived, across the railway down onto Mount Vernon Avenue, then onto Hamilton Road, otherwise she would have missed the bus. She wouldn't have caught it in time. Mm-hmm. This shortcut would include the same footpath on which Peter Manuel had assaulted a woman and a child 11 years earlier. So it's the same.
All
it's the same. Yeah, it's the same stomping ground. When she left home, Isabel was wearing a blue raincoat, a blue and white dress, a headscarf with a map of France on it, and earrings shaped like the Eiffel Tower, nylon stockings and tan slip-on shoes. And she was carrying a beige vanity case where she had her dancing shoes inside and her makeup bag and a little bit of money. Isabel had made plans to meet up with her boyfriend Douglas Bryden outside the dance. Douglas would later tell police he'd waited 45 minutes outside the hall before giving up and heading inside alone. That night, the family phone was out of order and the family took small comfort in the theory that she'd had to stay with a friend and couldn't get in touch to inform them. So I think they're clutching at straws, they're mm-hmm. hoping against hope she's going to turn up in the morning and say, "Sorry, Mum, couldn't get through on the phone." Mm. But William, he was very worried. He couldn't sleep and he got up and he went and searched with a torch all the route that he thought she was going to take. And it would later be identified as a spot on which his daughter had been attacked hours earlier. He found nothing, however, because by that time, Isabel Cook was already lying in a shallow grave.
Oh, no.
When Isabel was still not returned in the morning, her parents reported her disappearance to the police. and at about 4:30 that afternoon, the police recovered Isabel's purse from the railway line. This discovery was closely followed by the recovery of some of her clothing, her coat, her underwear, her case, like all of her belongings, again, scattered Jesus. In various locations nearby. Once Manuel had been informed as the girl's killer, it would be discovered that the scattering of Isabel's belongings formed an almost straight line leading from the Cook home to the Manuel home. An example of how arrogant he was.
Yeah.
So he's almost going saying to the police, look, follow this trail of breadcrumbs and you'll find the killer.
Fucker.
So it's completely... So yeah, even though they found all of her belongings, they couldn't find her body. They would search nearby areas of water with frogmen and disused mine shafts. They had a tip off at one point that her body had been discarded in a railway carriage. So they were searching, obviously. It could be anywhere in the blooming country then, couldn't it?
Yeah.
So it was a nationwide search, literally. She was on the front cover of all the newspapers for a couple of weeks. But they couldn't. It was all to no avail. They just couldn't find her body. And the documentary I watched the other day about this case, they tracked Dan Douglas, her boyfriend.
Oh.
And it's quite poignant, really, because he was 16 on the day that she went missing. She was 17. And when they're interviewing him, he's like pretty much an old man. It just shows the passing of time. Yeah. Isabel, they put these beautiful... Like, Isabel was a stunner. Like,
she was wearing.
Yeah, she sounds very trendy.
Mm.
And the pictures of her, she's very good looking. She's got dark hair, dark eyes, beautiful heart-shaped face. And Douglas said that she was like one of the best-looking girls at school. They met when they were about 14.
Oh.
And they've been dating for 3 years or so when she died. And he did say she was one. And she's absolutely gorgeous. And she will forever remain... 17 age, years old, gorgeous, beautiful, whereas poor old Douglas looked like he could do with some new false teeth.
Love him.
But he still remembers. I mean, you remember things much more clearly from when you're a youngster, don't you? And he speaks very fondly of her. They were very much in love, very happy couple.
Oh,
and
love him.
Yeah, but I just found that really poignant, the passing of time. She's always going to be frozen in time.
Yeah,
isn't
I don't
she?
Like that, yeah.
Yeah, she'll be in that black and white picture in her cute little bathing suit.
Oh, love her. Yeah.
So she would remain on the front pages until the 6th of January when the next one of his hideous crimes comes about.
Yeah, so ready for this one. So on the 6th of Jan, Peter, Doris and Michael Smart was found killed. The police knew they had been dead for some time, so they begin to investigate. The police were told by neighbours... So what had happened prior to this, Michael had a friend called David, and Michael had said to David, we're going to Minnans over Hogmanay, we're spending that holiday with the family, so I'll be back round about the 3rd of January, give me a knock and we'll go and have like a play date. So David assumed... He went knocking, I think, on the 2nd and the curtains were closed. And he went back on the 3rd and the curtains were open. And he found that quite odd. And neighbours also told the police that the curtains were, like, being drawn and opened and the lights were going on and off. So Peter, who was 45, Doris, who was 42, and Michael, who was 10. So what had happened was they were going to Doris's families for Hogmanay, but decided against it at last minute, and then decided to have friends and neighbours come round for Hogmanay instead. So the last hang-on, I believe, left, I think, about 2:30 in the morning. So they've all gone to bed, and Peter breaks in sometime after 2:30 and shoots the Smarts dead in their Uddingston. Is that right?
Uddingston, yeah.
Uddingston home in the early hours of the 1st of January. So pretty much from the 1st to the 6th, they're laying now. After the murders, Manuel stays in the house for nearly a week, eating their leftovers from Hogmanay and even feeding their family cat, before stealing some brand new banknotes that Peter Smart had kept for the holiday and taking the family car out and dumping it nearby. Manuel gives a lift in his car, so he's fucking cocksure of this, to a police officer. He gives someone, a police officer, a lift, and he was investigating this police officer, Isabel Cook's disappearance, and he's so frigging cocksure of himself, he tells him that he felt like the police were not looking in the right places. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's ridiculous. So, yeah. Unfortunately, they think he went and shot the two, like the parents first. Michael would have been alerted to this, but he was so scared he stayed in bed. And so the police then go, so David was knocking on the third and fourth and then finally told someone. The neighbours reported it. They come by the house on the sixth. Oh, and that someone noticed a window kept being open and shut. They think it was to, like, get the air going through the house to get rid of the smell of the dead bodies. Yeah. As soon as they opened that door, the smell of dead bodies hit their face. And they said, yeah, they went upstairs and found them, unfortunately, dead in their beds.
Horrible, isn't it? Creepy as hell.
Vile. Fucking vile.
So, yeah, Mr. Smart, Father Smart, like you say, he'd taken out some, he'd gone to the bank, must have been New Year's Eve, and taken out some sequential banknotes. That means every single banknote has got a like identification number on it, and these were sequential, so it was very easy to identify these banknotes. And Peter Manuel just goes out and starts spending them. Obviously, with the massive similarities between the Smart killings and the Watt killings, the scattering of the staff, all the burglaries, you'd have to be an idiot not to go knocking on Peter Manuel's door once the Smarts are discovered. So it was the new banknotes stolen in the Smart killings which were finally to be his undoing, that and a tip-off by spending them freely, particularly in pubs in Glasgow's East End. Police traced the notes to the Smart murders, and after they arrested his father, Manuel confessed to 8 killings, but not the Watt murders, although he was subsequently to confess even to those. So the police arrested, they went to search his house, they found the banknotes. So they arrested Peter and Samuel, is it Samuel, his dad?
Yeah, Samuel.
Yeah, they arrested both of them, because I suppose they don't know, it could be either of them, couldn't it?
Of course it could, and where Samuel's the name, Billy, and it Peter?
Yeah,
you don't know, he might be, instigating or whatever, of course.
I wouldn't be surprised if he actually had been an accomplice. That's what I thought, to be fair. Anyway, so the policeman is in charge of this. He knows what a show-off Peter Manuel is. He knows how much he likes to blow his own trumpet. So what he does is he leaves him in his cell for a few hours just to stew in his own juice. So eventually when they bring him out to interview him, he's desperate to offload. Anyway, he says, I'll tell you everything, but you've got to let my dad go. My dad's got nothing to do with it. So they release Manuel Sr. And he confesses to everything. He tells him everything. Then, to back it up, he led detectives to the place at Burntbroom Farm in Uddingston, where Isabel Cook's half-naked body was recovered. He led police to the shallow grave where the body of Isabel had been buried, even callously telling the policeman, I think you're standing on her.
Oh, no.
Next, he took them to a spot on the River Clyde near the High Court where he said he'd thrown the guns used in the shootings. In the river, divers found the Webley revolver, which had killed the Watts, and the Beretta automatic used on the Smarts. I thought that was really impressive, actually, to be able to find two guns in the river, especially, like, in January.
I know.
It's a bit dark and
fucking
cold.
When you said about Scotland being freezing, I just thought that.
No, this is January. Yeah. I mean, crumbs, it must be so cold.
Yeah.
The term serial killer hadn't been, obviously, thought of at this point. Yeah, coined, thank you, in the late 1950s, and neither were their profilers or anything like that. So we could say Peter Manuel could lay claim to be one of the first. His confessions, his overweening arrogance, scripting his starring role in his own courtroom drama were clearly aimed at establishing a lasting infamy. If the case had been tried today, perhaps Manuel might have pleaded diminished responsibility and it might just have succeeded, because there's little doubt that he was a psychopath, although evidence of his mental health was kept from the jury at the time. His trial began on the 12th of May, 1958. He is now pleading not guilty to all charges. He sacked his counsel again and conducted his own defence. And although the judge conceded that he was very skilled at it, you know, it sounds a bit... In my head, it's like, there's a good boy. Yeah, yeah. You've done really good, Peter, but sorry, we're still going to hang you. That's in my mind. Yeah. Obviously, it wasn't, but in my mind, I'm reading this. I'm just thinking, are they just like patronising him a little bit
it
off?
It sounds like it.
It feels like it, isn't it?
It does.
So the evidence was so overwhelming that it took the jury less than 3 hours to convict him.
Wow.
Yeah, there's a little poem that he wrote. I'll read it out. I murdered Isabella Cook and young Anne Nealance too. Shot the Watts and shot the Smarts and Sydney Dunn I slew. I did these deeds without a doubt. My guilt was found by law. I'm Peter Anthony Manuel, the Rat of Berkenshaw. But many people believe that the true count of his murder rampage could have been as high as 19. And understandably, there was no real outcry when the judge, Lord Cameron, donned the black cap and passed the sentence of death by hanging. On Friday, the 11th of July 1958, hangman Harry Allen appeared at the door of the Barlinnie cell just before 8 a.m. A priest was saying his last words and Peter Manuel then went smartly to the scaffold. His hands were tied behind his back, a white hood placed over his head and the noose fitted around his neck. Apparently, his last words were, "Turn up the radio and I'll go quietly," but that could be bollocks, we don't know.
Yeah.
So, and Scotland's Frankenstein, or as he called himself, the Beast of Berkenshaw, died at 8:05 a.m.
By so Felicia.
Very quick.
Yeah.
Skillful sort of hanging. That fella there, Harry Allen, is the one, the hangman's tale.
The one that I was just going to ask you.
Yeah. Because I think Peter Manuel wrote another poem. He wrote quite a few poems. And one of them was, "Now Pierrepoint has retired, who will hang me now?" That kind of thing. So that's who it was. Harry Allen was Pierrepoint's apprentice.
Ah,
okay. So there we have it. But I think he was like the second to last or the third to last person to be hung in Scotland or something, yeah. Wasn't he? It was just coming to the end of the old capital punishment days, yeah. Wasn't it?
Unfortunately so.
Yeah, true. So that just about wraps it up. But I've done a 6 degrees.
Oh, thank God for that. Woohoo!
So here we are. We play a game at the end of some of our episodes where we try to connect the subject matter of the case that we've covered
mm-hmm.
with the lovely actor Kevin Bacon. So this week I've gone with... There's a TV programme that was made a couple of years ago called In Plain Sight.
Yes.
Which is about this case and... I tried every bloody thing.
Me too, to find
it. It's just not on the telly anywhere, is it? It's just not on there. Even Amazon Prime, you pick it and it says this video is unavailable. Yeah. So it's there, all three episodes.
But you can't watch it.
But you can't play it.
Yeah. And I was like, isn't it frustrating?
Yeah.
Yep.
Even on YouTube, you can only watch the trailers. Because I thought it looked really good, actually. In a few podcasts I listened to, they recommended it, didn't they? So it's really good.
Yep. Couldn't bloody get it. No, I was exactly the
same. Yeah. So in my frustration, I thought, oh, I'll put it in my 6 degrees.
Well done.
So there's an actor called Martin Compston who played Peter Manuel in the show Plain Sight. He plays Steve Arnott in Line of Duty.
Okay.
I ain't seen it. Have you seen it? No, it's supposed to be good, but I haven't seen it. With an actress who I absolutely love, a lovely Scottish actress called Kelly MacDonald. She plays the maid Mary in Gosford Park,
okay.
Which is one of my favourite films ever. It's such a good whodunit. With Ryan Phillippe.
I love Ryan Phillippe.
Yeah, he's so sexy back in the day, wasn't he?
Oh.
Beautiful in Cruel Intentions.
Cruel Intentions, yes.
Where he met his wife, Sarah Michelle Gellar, who starred in a film called The Air I Breathe with Kevin Bacon.
Well done.
Thanks very much.
Very impressed. So very impressed.
That's that for Peter Manuel. We weren't sure whether to say Manuel or Manuel, was we?
No.
We were debating
it. I was calling him Manuel the whole time up until yesterday.
Most people say Manuel, so we went with Manuel, but we're not sure, so
no.
That's what we went with.
Yeah, I liked it. Well done. Woo-hoo.
Yeah. So anyway, that brings the end of the case. I would just like to thank you all very much for tuning in, listening, downloading. I really hope you're enjoying Series 6, Bloody Britain. And if you're enjoying the series, if you like what we make, please feel free to spread the word. If you wouldn't mind telling your friends and family about us, we're on all the platforms where you can listen to a podcast. And if you just put in Blue Murder Club, it'll bring up our huge back catalogue that we've got. If you give us some nice 5-star reviews, we'd appreciate it very much. And, you know, like us, share us, spread the word, please.
Fleshers. No, I don't mean that. Yes, thank you so much. Come over and join us on Patreon. We've got some great things over there going. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, we'll see you on the other side.
Thanks for listening. Take care and have a good week.
Bye.